This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, and joining me this week for the first time, Kim McAllister.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well.
Good.
I'm very well. Just explain briefly what your background is. What do you do normally?
Oh, what do I do? I'm a journalist. I also have a media company, which I've been running for about 10 years now. So I freelance as a journalist, and I also help with communication strategy for companies.
And this podcast is looking at an issue that is of real interest to you.
Yeah, I was really fascinated to explore this rewilding issue, which I know it's very controversial. I know people feel strongly one way or another, but as I investigated it, I realised that I could kind of take it on a personal journey and hear the pros and cons and figure out how it actually feels to reconnect with the landscape.
Well, just to put this into context, back in April, Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, declared a climate emergency and pledged, and I'm quoting here, to live up to our responsibility to halt climate change. So right now we're in the midst of a big climate conversation, an initiative by the Scottish Government to tackle the emergency and find ways of becoming a net zero emissions nation by 2045, which is pretty ambitious.
It is ambitious, and a major part of that discussion is inevitably going to be the role that nature can play to help us to establish a low carbon economy. Things like planting trees and restoring peatland.
Rewilding is one of those amorphous terms. It's a bit like sustainability. It means different things to different people. It's commonly associated in Scotland with the reintroduction of predators like wolves and lynx, but there is a lot more to it than that, as Kim's been discovering.
I'm a city girl. I was brought up in Glasgow, I worked in Aberdeen, and now I live in Edinburgh. In fact, right now I'm not too far from the top of Arthur's Seat, looking out over this gorgeous city in the middle of the fringe madness, thinking, it's not a bad place to live. But I spent most of my childhood holidays on the Isle of Arran. And the thought of losing our forests and our beaches and our wildlife, God, it just terrifies me. We have a climate emergency. We're killing our planet. So how can we help to revive it? I think the most important way we can do that is through rewilding. Rewilding. What does that actually mean? Well, where better to start this rewilding journey than a wilderness retreat? Allerdale in Sutherland was once a pretty standard sporting estate of 23,000 acres. 15 years ago, it was bought by Paul Lister, and he announced his plans to reintroduce wolves. Well, we'll look at that in more detail later, but first, his general manager, a very well-travelled Dutchman called Peter Paul Guggenhuyse, gave me a tour.
We're driving now into Glen Allerdale. Allerdale has some major exclusion zones, so we've got about 35 kilometres of deer fence around the reserve, and that's to keep deer out, obviously. And in this glen alone, we've planted hundreds of thousands of trees. Basically all the little green specks you can see in the distance.
And what types of trees have you planted while you've been doing this?
So Scots pine predominantly, and hazel, willow, birch, rowan, some aspen. So we're trying to create a mosaic of trees to bring some variation to the land, but predominantly Scots pine.
And what difference will that make to the land once they are mature?
That remains to be seen, because it's a long-term project. So Allerdale is not about know, quick progress. Trees grow really, really slow here. Everything you'll see has been planted between 7 and 10 years ago. So hopefully in about 100, 150 years' time, we'll have an established forest here, which hopefully will be home to much more animals than currently is the case. When the highlands were still covered in trees, that's the peak of that was about 5,000 years ago. And in time, everything has just been cleared. So there's the great forest of Caledon, there's only 1% left, I believe. And the most northerly remnant of that forest, you can see all the way down in the glen, the little speck of forest down there.
Yeah, I see it.
In the northern parts, that's what's left. In that sort of dome-shaped area, that's where we planted many, many trees. And again, just imagine what that would look like once they're fully grown.
It will change this landscape entirely, won't it? It's quite, I wouldn't say barren, but there's certainly not that many trees for such a large glen.
Well, and this is quite typical for the highlands, wouldn't you say? There's a lot of these glens around where what's missing are trees. And that balance between forest cover and deer population, that's basically what's off balance. Too many deer, not enough trees left. Some people say, you know, they're ecological dead zones compared to what it used to be. So rewilding, what we're doing, we like to think of it as the definition is ecosystem restoration.
Ecosystem restoration. Doesn't that sound encouraging? As I'll discover later from Peter, there's actually quite a lot more to rewilding than that, and it becomes much more personal. So if we're going to explore ecosystem restoration a bit more, as Peter suggested, the woodlands of the future could be home to many more animals, some of which used to live here but were hunted to extinction. I'll discuss wolves with Paul Lister later, but it's the lynx that's been attracting the most interest recently. Why is that? Dr. David Hetherington is an ecologist and the author of The Lynx and Us. He took me to an established woodland, the type we can hope to see at Allerdale in the future, and home to a large but rare bird.
So we're in Anagak Woods, just on the edge of Grantlands Bay, a really beautiful pine wood. It was actually planted 200 or so years ago, but it has a real feel of being an ancient Caledonian pine wood to it. It's a special protection area for capercaillie, a vanishingly rare bird these days in the Highlands, and this is one of the few pinewood areas that we still have in Scotland that have got a capercaillie population, albeit they're very difficult to see, they're very shy.
So I wanted to chat to you today about lynx,
yep,
which is your specialist subject. Can you tell us a little bit about the animal just to start with?
The Eurasian lynx, which is a species that would have once been found across Europe and Northern Asia, is the largest of the four lynx species that you see across the world. So it's about the same weight as a border collie, but maybe about the same height as a Labrador, not quite as chunky as a Labrador. And what makes it quite distinctive and different from the other three species of lynx is its diet. So because it's quite a lot larger than the other three, its diet is much more focused on things like roe deer. Roe deer, number one prey for a Eurasian lynx.
What do you reckon? Where would be a good place to reintroduce them?
Well, in terms of the habitat, we have more than enough habitat now in Scotland to support a lynx population. And it doesn't have to be some misty Caledonian forest of yore. It could be quite easily a very economic, very commercial Sitka spruce plantation. At the end of the day, that's got exactly what a lynx needs. It's got the cover, and it doesn't matter what nationality the trees are, and there's invariably going to be woodland deer in there. And again, the nationality of the deer isn't really an issue. So they could be Japanese sika deer, they could be native roe deer or even red deer calves. So I think there's a lot of habitat right across southern Scotland, in fact, over the border into Kildare, into England, but even more so north of the Central Belt, from Argyll to Aberdeenshire, right up to Caithness. We have, I would suggest, a very strong habitat network, mainly woodland, that lynx could thrive right across much of Scotland, living in our conifer plantations, as much as our nature reserves.
And it would be good for the ecosystem, would you suggest?
Well, they certainly have a role to perform. Yeah, they are, like I say, predators of woodland deer. And, of course, we do have predation on woodland deer these days, but it's performed by people. Typically, we leave very little behind. We might leave the gralloch, you know, the intestines, but the rest of the carcass is coming out. Whereas, of course, when a lynx kills a deer, it's doing that all year round, irrespective of any hunting season. It's not particularly favouring any sex or age class of deer. And what it doesn't eat is left on the forest floor to decompose. So it could be fed on, in the meantime, by a wide range of species, from beetles to eagles. But things like, you know, the bones and whatnot will eventually decompose and return, you know, the sun's energy and the minerals and nutrients back into the soil to feed the forest, if you like.
And would there be any benefit in terms of tourism? Would there be economic benefits for that community?
There's definitely a growing phenomenon of large carnivore tourism in Europe. We see that in a variety of countries, from Spain to Italy to Romania to Finland. And typically, you know, you can spend a lot of money to go and stay in a little shed in the woods. You can spend hundreds of euros doing that, and the chance that you're going to see a bear or a wolverine. I've done that myself in Finland. And there are parts of places like Spain or Italy where, again, you would stand, usually with a telescope or binoculars, in quite an open landscape with a big vista, looking for a wolf pack moving around the landscape. And, you know, local hotels and restaurants are definitely marketing themselves to international wolf tourists. The problem with lynx is they don't come to bait, like bears and wolverines, and they don't wander around in the middle of the day in an open landscape waiting to be watched by tourists. It just doesn't happen, which might sound like there's no opportunity for lynx tourism. However, we see in quite a few German national parks that they use the lynx as a branding icon. It's a case of attracting people to the landscape by promoting the fact that there are lynx living in that landscape. And then, of course, there's a whole issue about the economics of their predation on deer. We know that deer, the grazing and browsing activities of deer, particularly on forestry but also on agriculture, is a multi-million pound cost here in Scotland. And, you know, lynx are going to be in the woodlands potentially, unsalaried, and doing deer management all year round. So that could have ecological and economic benefits. So, for example, Forestry and Land Scotland, the public sector forest industry in Scotland, manages one third of Scotland's woodlands. And it's spending around about £5 million every year on, you know, deer management. It's a net cost to the public purse of £5 million. That's, you know, deer fencing, having people to go out and control deer, the damage that they can cause to the timber crop. So conceivably, lynx could be in the forest performing a six- or seven-figure deer management service.
Dr. David Hetherington. So the idea of reintroducing the lynx could potentially have wide-ranging benefits. Now, I'm a business journalist, so I'm always interested in the economics of big decisions. Let's look at the case study of the white-tailed sea eagle. They were reintroduced to Scotland in three phases, starting in the 1970s, and they've now become synonymous with mull. Dave Sexton is the RSPB's officer there.
Mull Eagle Watch began in 2000, so this is our 20th season. And it was unique and different completely at the time, because no one else was showing white-tailed eagle nests. This was a rare bird in those days. But a bit like the ospreys at Loch Garten and elsewhere, that decision was taken that actually this is a big, bold bird that people are seeing. You can't keep hiding it away. And actually having lots of eyes watching this bird is good for the bird. And it ended up being very good for local economy and tourism. And Mull has now built its tourism reputation pretty much on wildlife tourism. And for the bulk of the people coming, white-tailed eagles and, of course, golden eagles are at the top of their list of things they want to see. So we're able to show now from economic studies that up to £5 million a year has been coming to the Mull economy solely on the back of white-tailed eagle tourism. That study's 10-plus years old now, so we're going to look to redo that and see how things have changed. But there's no doubt, just casually chatting to people coming off the boat and in the shops, it's the eagles that they're here for. Once they're here, they're spending money on lots of other things, of course, across the island, but that is often the trigger.
While the sea eagles are making money for mull, they're not without their issues when it comes to taking lambs. That discussion's for another day. Another famous sheep predator, well, at least in the cartoons, is the wolf. These were hunted to extinction in Scotland, but conservationist and landowner Paul Lister is determined to bring them back. Why?
And Allerdale was bought because solely I wanted to create a 50,000 acre wolf reserve, like a wildlife reserve, but where large predators such as the wolf could manage the deer population better than we could as people with rifles. Of course, in so doing, you'd have to manage the wolf population eventually because you'd have to intervene. But it's a lot easier to manage 10 to 15 wolves than it would be to manage 1,000 deer. One of the things it didn't have was scale.
Right.
And so that's always been our biggest challenge, is to get enough land to do the project, because you wouldn't want to put a pack of wolves in an area of 15 or 20,000 acres. You know, it's not big enough, you know. I've always done my sums around two packs of wolves. I know how much prey they eat, and I know how much deer we have, and it's a calculation. And then the knowledge we have from our projects in Italy, Spain and Romania also help with understanding the numbers. So here we are, you know, in 2019, and we haven't yet got the wolves back, but we're thinking about building a small wolf enclosure where we can at least design a fence that's suitable and get people used to seeing them in a highland environment. So that's something we're working on in the next 12 months.
And how are you feeling about it? It's a long time to work on a project.
Well, of course, I'm a very impatient person, and most people that know me think, my goodness, you're still stuck at it. But, you know, I've kind of fallen in love with the place. We don't do deer stalking anymore. We actually do that in-house. We don't have any hunters coming up. And now I've got rid of that element of the operation. The other business has flourished. People get clarity over what we're doing. I would say our occupancy levels here are probably 75% if you took our four lodges and multiplied them all out. 75% of a 40-week year, because we close for 3 months.
And what kinds of business, if you don't have the deer stocking, what kinds of things are you making money from?
Well, I think the obvious ones, the people that come up that would object to that kind of activity, will be yoga retreats, mindfulness retreats. We do Wim Hof ice retreats. We do lots of corporate launches. Maybe it's a 4x4 or a vehicle of some sort. Family groups. This week I had guests from Australia and South Africa. And it's wonderful. You know, they've been following our course, and it's all on this sort of bucket list. We become sort of a bucket list thing to do. Let's go up and visit that land up in the north of Scotland where they keep talking about wolves. And so you know, it's created quite an attraction, and we're happy with that. We have a lot of people who loves to cycle here. You know, we have got some good tracks. So really, the deer hunting business has been, or stalking, I should say, has been replaced by a multitude and a variety. And like any business, it's good to have a variety of revenues streams, because, you know, if you're just a highland deer state, you know, you get revenue for 6 or 8 weeks of the year, and that's it. So we now...
So you think it's been quite a good business decision then?
Yes, I do. Of course, I was, you know, with my trustees, we were always battling over it, and they said, oh, boy, you can't let it go. And, you know, we decided together that it was worth a try, and we haven't looked back. I mean, it's only been, you know, 18 months since we had our last stalker up here, but, you know, I'm really happy about it. And we can get on and do the job internally with our ranger team, and they can go about it in a military style.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to go through all the sort of rigmarole and palaver of stalking with a guest. We just get out there and do the job.
Yeah.
And that brings in a very different result, and you can do the work in probably 25% of the time.
That sums up Scotland to me. The waterfall and the trees and the sunshine, and you just need a golden eagle to swoop over and a salmon to jump out of the water, and you've got the whole picture. I think the interesting thing about rewilding, it's obviously a controversial topic, but it doesn't mean throwing up fences and keeping people out, does it?
No, I think it's a very important to realize that rewilding does not mean excluding people. Rewilding is, as far as I know, the opportunity to reconnect to nature. But we need nature to do that. So rewilding is basically restoring something, ecosystem restoration, so more and more people can actually enjoy it, live a healthier life because of it. It certainly doesn't mean let's keep people out.
In terms of rewilding Scotland in general, there's obviously a big conversation about wolves. We've had very successful reintroduction of sea eagles. The beavers seem to be doing well as well. Do you think that there's now a kind of a public appetite for rewilding in general?
I think there's definitely a growing interest in rewilding. You know, loads of social media accounts have popped up all about rewilding. There's loads of books coming out about rewilding. There's much more discourse about it. Yeah, for sure, it's definitely ignited a public interest. At the same time, I think there's probably at the other end of the spectrum a growing body of people who are very nervous about rewilding and what it might mean. And of course, invariably, it's shown in newspapers with a wolf howling or something like that. It's like, oh my word! So rewilding can carry all sorts of perceived threats. And of course, one of those is that somehow rewilding is equated to depeopling. And we've had an awful lot of depeopling in Scotland, particularly in the Highlands over the years. Many people will say that's the last thing we want is rewilding, because in their minds, it's about getting people out of the glen and letting it all go back to nature. I personally don't think that's what rewilding is, and it certainly doesn't have to be like that. But that's I think the conversation is going like that. It's at risk of becoming a bit polarised, actually.
Dr. David Hetherington. On the European continent, the concept of rewilding is actually quite different to here. As Franz Schepper, Managing Director of Rewilding Europe, explained to Helen Needham.
We strive towards a situation where there are spaces in Europe where nature can take care of itself, where natural processes guide the development of landscapes, where people are welcome guests, and where people can benefit in many different ways, but where nature actually is taking the lead.
Because people here are sometimes afraid of the term rewilding because they think it means that it's about taking people away from places and leaving it to nature. What's your response to that?
Well, I think this is a complete misunderstanding, and I think everybody realises in Europe there is only one way forward, and this is coexistence of people with nature. And we are working in many areas in Europe where there's rural depopulation. I think it's also happening in large parts of the UK, and where young people move to cities and where older generations are staying behind, where there is a need for looking at new options or additional options, if you like. In fact, I dare to say that in many ways, looking at this, call it socioeconomic trends on much of the countryside in Europe, actually attracting new people to come and live in the countryside, especially younger generations. A lot of people don't want to become a farmer anymore. That's a reality as well. But maybe to come back and develop a business or have a job which is linked to a rewilded landscape. And there is huge opportunities all across Europe for this. So we are not looking only at the nature bouncing back, which it will if we provide the opportunity, but it's also about people bouncing back in a way that we support the development of new businesses and enterprises that are based on such wilder landscapes and wildlife comeback.
The water is so clear. I think I'm going to have to drink from it. I might take my shoes and socks off and get right in there. Yes. I'm going to have to roll my trousers up. It's a little bit deeper than I thought. Oh, it's cold.
Good for you.
It's cold and it's fresh and it's invigorating. Oh, this is gorgeous. Look at the sun glinting off the water. Right, I'm going to take a big handful. Yeah, it's good for the soul, that. Really fresh. Tastes amazing. You can make some good whiskey from this water, you know.
Absolutely.
Have you thought about that?
So, how are you feeling, Kim, spending a bit of time here?
I feel so calm. I've spent a lot of time in Arran growing up, and a lot of parts of the island are similar to this, you know, the rivers and the hills and the sunshine if you're lucky, but it's just so peaceful, you know. There's nothing here apart from us, and the wind, and you can't see anything except for the wild hills. You know, there's no cities or towns, or I mean, I can't even see a proper building where we are right now for miles and miles. It's a treat to be so far removed from civilization. It really is. It's a really special place, and it's kind of inspiring to think that this is where we're going to start to repair some of the damage we've done to this world, you know. Have you got a kind of deadline for yourself if you can't push this through?
No, I don't have a deadline. I just think that, I don't worry about it. I don't obsess about wolves. You know, I just think that we're just missing a trick. And I think that the magic of what's been created at Yellowstone, with an additionality of $40 million a year added to the local community just through wolf tourism. Mm. You know, I just think if we could do 10% of that, it would be significant up in these communities. I mean, if we have 2,000 people currently visiting an area of 50,000 acres around us, whether it be our guests or hill walkers or cyclists or horseback riders or my neighbour's guests, when you bring wolves back to the area, you'd probably get up to more like 15, 20,000 people, but spread through the year.
Yeah.
Because some people wouldn't want to come up in the winter. Some would want to come up in the winter because it's the best time to see the wolves. You know, I'm more about connecting people to nature than I am about anything else. Unless we really start to appreciate and understand nature, you know, I think we're heading for the proverbial brick wall. Mm. So the more people we can get out into the countryside and really understand it and connect with it and fall in love with it, then, you know, we will be happy once we get that done. And that's really what we're trying to do. It's not just about the wolves. It's about bringing more people out of cities and getting to appreciate trees and forests and nature, and not just understanding the concrete world that we live in.
Well, rewilding doesn't mean depeopling, does it?
No, absolutely not. Rewilding, all it means is perhaps turning over more land that we've used for maybe agriculture or deer hunting or grouse moors or whatever it might be, letting it get back to where it was, you know, 500, 600, 700 years ago, and at the same time sequestering a lot of carbon and getting people out into it so they can enjoy it. You know, when you think about the people that want to shoot things with a gun or a rifle versus people that shoot things with a camera, I think we all know what the statistics are. I don't need to say them. And I think that's really what we need to work on.
Do you get many cyclists and walkers and people exploring this part of the world?
Yeah, a little bit, especially in summer, of course. You know, people have a little bit more time on their hands. Quite a few mountain bikes and ramblers. I've met people who walk from Land's End to John O'Groats. It's always amazing to meet them. Everyone has a story, you know. Yeah. We always stop and for a chat. And others are very into their mountain biking and they're just ploughing on. And that's fine. But we do see a fair amount of them.
And you do want people to come and enjoy what you're doing here. It's not exclusive in any way, is it?
No, but you know, at the end of the day, we are a combination of a wilderness reserve with a hospitality side of things. And that's how we run Ellerdale. Is that fully exclusive? No, because people still can hike through these lands. Rewilding is not just about creating wilderness. It is about reconnecting to something that's already there in all of us. So I think rewilding is far more a personal thing than the grand gesture of, you know, restoring nature. Because, again, it's all about balance. But the result of, to me, is something that's personal and inside for all of us. That's what it should mean, is a healthier lifestyle in balance with nature. Yeah,
I agree. I mean, I live in Edinburgh. I live in a suburb, you know, surrounded by people and houses and shops and life. And then I come somewhere like this and it's almost like it's a different side of myself that's here. And I'm not sure that that's how we should live, two halves of ourselves. I mean, we're lucky we have the opportunity to do both, but wouldn't it be nice if we could integrate that a little bit better?
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But nothing changes if you go back home and that way of life perpetuates itself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
You have to make some big decisions, don't you? You have to prioritise things quite brutally, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Would you change anything? After coming here and seeing this, do you think, would it make you think differently?
Do you know, it's just made me realise how much we sweat the small stuff. You know, especially when you have a young family or you're working hard or you're trying to pay your bills, you get so caught up in the mundane life, you know, and the decisions that you have to make every minute of the day and the demands on you. And then you come somewhere like this and you go, oh, do you know what? Life's not so bad. I'm perfectly happy with my feet in a river and, you know, my hair blowing in the wind. You know, I think where I am in Edinburgh, I'm lucky I'm next to the Pentland Hills, and we do frequently go into the hills with the children. And the difference in them, you know, the difference in them when they're just kicking about in the trees and finding sticks and throwing stones in the river, and that's where they're happiest. So we do spend a lot of time outside and we do recognise how important it is for all our mental health.
You don't have to be a kid to do that, by the way.
I feel like a kid when I do that.
Yeah, and that's also important to realise, you know. But at 43, I love walking through the river and just, you know, getting crutches on my arm because we're just outside. You know, don't, as an adult, don't forget that play is still a very big part of life. You know, and it keeps your energy up, and it keeps your inventiveness and your creativity up. That's also part of being outside in nature. It's not just for the wee ones. You know, it's for us. It's equally important.
For all of us, definitely. Yeah.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.